KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, Context, Culture, and Connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, Brown versus Board of Education in jeopardy.
The allegations that the Sausalito Marin City School District intentionally created these separate but unequal schools, that is not so common, but the segregation part is.
Then a samba dancer in Oakland answers the call of the African drum.
I would just go to bed and I hear this rhythm in my mind just going and going, and I had no idea it was drums in that way.
And we'll take you behind the scenes at San Francisco's Conservatory of Flowers.
You know, there's a reason they don't make greenhouses out of wood anymore. But it's totally worth it.
After hours, behind those whitewashed walls. It's all coming up today on Cross Currents. The state attorney general recently announced that his office had brokered the first settlement to desegregate a California school in 5 decades, right here in Marin County. Now, this story we're going to hear takes place in one school district that includes 2 schools in 2 towns. Marin City's population is majority Black and Latino. Sausalito, which is its far more affluent neighbor just across the freeway, it's 90% white. The state alleged the district poured resources into its Sausalito school while starving its Marin City school. But it turns out schools across the country have been resegregating for decades. KALW's education reporter Lee Romney's here to talk about it. So Lee, for starters, how did we get here?
Okay, I'm going to take you back to give you some context, way back.
All right.
For starters, this year marks the 65th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. That's the landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional.
Right, famous case. So that was in 1954, and that's when desegregation of schools began in the United States.
In theory, yes, but in practice, not much changed in a lot of places, including the district in southern Marin County. At that time, it included Sausalito, Mill Valley, the military forts by the bay, and Marin City. And those communities ranged from wealthy and white to high poverty African-American communities. So a decade after Brown v. Board of Ed, the schools there were still segregated along racial lines.
But the Supreme Court had outlawed that, right? So were officials putting pressure on the district to integrate at that point?
Yeah, they were. And a state investigation actually led to big and rather sudden changes. By the fall of 1965, all students of a certain grade level were going to the same school. So the district was busing a lot of kids. And I actually found a newspaper article from late that year, 1965, that said it was, quote, reported to be the first district in the nation to have racially integrated all its schools.
Wow. The Southern Marin County School District.
Yeah.
It's
pretty
amazing.
Crazy. Yeah. I know. I was surprised. Yeah. So I'm going to fast forward now. Now a lot. Decades go by and there are an increasing number of complaints that the schools aren't good enough. And a lot of white families start leaving what by then had become the Sausalito Marin City School District, and some Black families too. So in direct response, the district approves this charter school in Sausalito in 2001. Willow Creek Academy.
Okay.
And it grows really fast and has a ton of support from the district, which in 2013 decides to close its traditional public elementary school in Sausalito.
Huh.
So that means all the Black and Latino kids who'd been coming into Sausalito from Marin City are now staying in Marin City at an expanded K-8 school. And that is Bayside Martin Luther King.
Okay, so that's the school that's allegedly segregated here, right?
Yeah.
It didn't start that way, though, did it?
Well, not really. It got worse. When they expanded that school to be a K-8 school, enrollment dropped and it continued to drop. And as that happened, the school got more segregated. Only 8 white kids attended last year out of 119.
Huh.
Yeah. So in comparison, Willow Creek, the charter, which is much bigger, is 42% white, 26% Latino, and a little over 10% Black.
Well, at least in comparison, that sounds pretty balanced.
Yeah, it does. But when you look more deeply at the data, it shows that Bayside MLK is serving a much higher percentage of the district's neediest kids, the low-income kids and English language learners.
And so State Attorney General Javier Becerra said that that segregation was intentional, right?
Yeah, and that's what made the big headlines. The investigation alleged the district had, quote, knowingly and intentionally maintained and exacerbated existing racial segregation. And they allegedly did it by cutting Bayside programs while giving extra funding to Willow Creek. And Becerra, the state AG, called the district actions wicked, warped, and morally bankrupt.
Yeah, those are pretty severe allegations. So I'm wondering, though, Lee, how unusual is this?
Well, for this part, I'm going to bring in an expert.
My name is Erica Frankenberg.
She's a professor at Penn State University, where she directs the Center for Education and Civil Rights. The allegations that the Sausalito Marin City School District intentionally created these separate but unequal schools, that is not so common, but the segregation part is.
For Black and Latino students, the percentage of students in highly segregated schools continues to rise, and this is particularly important to think about the trends for Black students because at one point in time, the segregation that existed prior to 1954 had been dramatically reduced. And unfortunately, since the late 1980s, that has been on a steady increase.
Why is that?
Well, because after Brown v. Board of Education, the federal courts put in place a lot of desegregation orders with a focus on Black students. And starting in the early 1990s, the courts started lifting them all.
Mm. So that's what African-American students have experienced. What about other kids?
Well, Professor Frankenberg points out, interestingly, that white students are the most likely to wind up in racially isolated schools, schools that are more than two-thirds white.
So you mentioned that charter school in Sausalito, it had less than half white kids, like 42%. So it's not racially isolated by that term.
No, it's not. That's correct. But almost all the district's white students go there. So that's made Bayside MLK what experts call racially isolated.
Right.
And, you know, super racially isolated. It's more than three-fourths Black and Latino.
So in general, are charter schools contributing to this kind of segregation in public schools across the country?
Yeah, in some cases, not always, but in some cases, they're pulling in white families, making it harder for traditional public schools to desegregate. And Frankenberg says a lot of these separate but unequal situations are cropping up in suburbs, where some districts are allowing it to happen to appease white and more affluent parents so they'll stay.
Okay, so Brown versus Board of Education is a famous federal case. But here, in this one, it was the state attorney general who did the investigation.
Exactly. The fact that the state AG took it on is unusual, but it's kind of a new trend. Other state attorneys general have started taking on desegregation cases, too.
There is a multi-decade segregation case in Hartford, Connecticut area based on the state constitution. There are challenges ongoing right now in Minnesota and New Jersey around the way in which school district boundary lines may contribute to existing school segregation that I think are really important. The New Jersey one also include something about the way in which state charter school statutes might relate to segregation.
And also, a relatively new coalition called the Education Civil Rights Alliance has been working with state AGs in a bunch of states to preserve the civil rights of students, so states taking on a larger role. Mm-hmm. And this is all because federal education officials and federal courts have largely backed away.
Okay, so let's circle back to the Sausalito Marin City School District. What's going to happen now, Lee?
Well, a lot of people who were more directly involved in some of the financial decisions that the state AG criticized in his investigation are no longer with the district. And everyone pretty much wants to move forward. There's a new superintendent. He's Latino and grew up in Southern Marin County.
Local.
Yep. And the school board, which used to tilt to favor Willow Creek, now doesn't. So the board agreed to this settlement, which is a big deal.
What's the settlement?
The district agrees to desegregate within 5 years, and there's a lot of remediation built in for kids who attended Bayside MLK over the past 6 years.
Huh.
Academic or career counseling and a scholarship program for 2 years of college or trade school.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Lee.
Thanks for having me.
Lee Romney is our education reporter. You can reach her at education@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Now, let's turn from education to the arts. One day, Theo Achon Williams was walking through North Oakland when he heard drumming. No matter where he traveled, the feeling he got from hearing those beats wouldn't leave him. So he decided to make it his career. Today, he's sharing his love for music and dance with the Bay Area through Samba Funk, a collective of dancers and drummers with a carnival sound. Samba Funk will perform at this Saturday's Black Eyed Pea Festival in Oakland. Theo sat down to tell KALW's Janae Darden what drew him to the beat.
I grew up around the lake, Lake Merritt District, but my family had interests. It was a church on 98th because I grew up in a real spiritual household. And that was back in the day where you went early and you stayed late.
During this time, the drum called you.
Yeah, I was with my mom who went to visit one of her friends who actually was participating in a dance class that I found out later that was led by Ruth Beckford at Mosswood Park. And she just was going to connect with one of her friends. She brought me along with her. And it was an African dance class. I had no idea. I had really not been connected to the drum in that way. And that spirit of the drum and that rhythm, it stayed with me I didn't know what it was. I was a young adult at Clark. Mm-hmm. And I would just go to bed or nod off. And I hear this rhythm in my mind, this polyrhythm just going and going. And I had no idea it was, you know, drums in that way. And then finally it dawned on me. I don't remember if I was at a Kwanzaa or if I was at an event. And it just like, bop, bop. That's what that is. And, you know, that's when I began taking up African dance.
And so you left the Bay, you went to college, San Diego State, or State, for those of us who live in San Diego,
right.
And you were mentored by Danny Scarborough, who is a legend with the Alvin Ailey Dance Company. He won an Emmy for choreographing Roots.
Yeah.
That's amazing. What impact did he have on you?
Dr. Scarborough, Danny was a man. He was a tall, slender brother that... He was the first person that really showed me a sense of Black artistic excellence. He was the first person that taught me about the Harlem Renaissance and just the names and the personalities that made up the Harlem Renaissance. He had actually a class at State that was called Harlem Renaissance, and at the end of the semester, you would take on a character and you show up at this party. And you be that character throughout the whole party, whether that was, you know, County Cullum or James Weldon Johnson or O'Neill Hurston, whoever it was, you took on that Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, and you were that persona all throughout that it was like a soiree. And that's exactly how it was in Harlem because you had them all together,
yeah, they were all together
at the Cotton Club and various other clubs, and they were working together and doing things and just creating that whole Renaissance movement. So he was the first person that exposed me to that, that shared that to me. So that opened up a lot of knowledge and information to me. And then I got an invitation from a friend of mine who was the SGA president at Clark. And he was like, man, you need to come and finish school. You need to come. And they were marketing Atlanta as the Black Mecca at the time. This was Maynard Jackson was the mayor, and it was like the Black Mecca. And it was definitely wasn't the Atlanta that it is now. It didn't have the recognition. So yeah, I just cashed in everything and said, let me go to Atlanta and get enrolled in school at Clark. It was a private institution. It was a smaller thing, and I wanted to go down south. I wasn't scared of change and wasn't scared of leaving.
I've spent time at Historically Black College. I did an exchange program at Spelman. There's no experience like attending a HBCU. What did that do for you as an artist to attend Clark?
Well, it was awesome. I saw so much art in a different lens, you know, more in a Black Southern cultural lens, where we think of art, when we think of art, we may think of, I don't really want to just say the ballet, we may think of like more traditional formalized art, whether we're talking about a gallery opening or the symphony or something like that. But what I saw, when I saw art, I saw step shows, I saw gospel choirs, not that I hadn't seen gospel choirs before, but had more connection to the art that we created as African people and African-American people here, when you're talking about the basis of the blues, the foundation of the blues, you know, seeing clubs where they're playing old school music like that, barbershop quartet type music, even jazz coming out of New Orleans. So there was a lot more connection to art in that way. And when I went down there, it was just more about life, and the whole area was art. I kind of got started doing African dance in Atlanta. So we're talking about the 90s, and kind of just picked it up from there. For me, it was more about movement and connectivity.
So you left home and, you know, went to all these different places, and then when you came back, that's actually where you really found your passion.
Where things started jumping off, yeah. When I came here, I got involved with the African-Brazilian movement, and I had a good sister friend, her name is Regina Calloway. She asked me if I wanted to be involved with Carnival and if I wanted to join her group, which was called Fogo na Roupa, which is still around today. They work out of the Mission Cultural Center in San Francisco. So I went, and it was a really huge class. They had a charismatic, dynamic leader. His name is Carlos Acetuno, who I had studied with and learned a lot of my early techniques up from him. They had a big bateria, drummers. It was multicultural. I thought that was cool. Samba Funk is an arts organization. We're a collective of professional and non-professional artists. Everybody's a volunteer. It's a 100% volunteer organization. I'm the director, I guess you would say director, founder, founding director, and I'm a volunteer. I don't take a salary. I have a day job. And we uphold the tenets of African-Brazilian culture. I teach certain dances. I teach about the African diaspora. So we're seated in the African diaspora. That's really our core belief, is that the African diaspora exists. And for people, listeners that may not know what that is, that's speaking specifically to the remnants of the transatlantic slave trade, how many African nations were brought over here through the slave trade and broken up, families broken up, tribes, nations broken up, and distributed all throughout Latin America, South America, the Caribbean, and North America. So we have certain cultural traits that connect us and tie us that we brought over from Africa. And that whole area is the diaspora.
With all that's going on and everything we've talked about, what is your hope for the future of the arts community in Oakland? And what is your hope for the future of Samba?
I would hope that we would get more funding to create more art so we could reach more people, especially young people, and just spark creativity throughout Oakland. There has been a lot of creativity in the past in Oakland, but we need more, you know, and not to be made out of crises, but to be fostered with the intent of having a creative space, a safe space for people to create and feel good.
That was Theo Achon Williams, Artistic Director of Samba Funk. He spoke with KALW's Janae Darden. If you're in the mood for drumming and dancing, Samba Funk's performing at the Black Eyed Pea Festival this Saturday afternoon on the lawn at Oakland Tech High School. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney in for Hana Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the signature sounds of the Bay Area. We're going to hear one from San Francisco. If you've walked through Golden Gate Park, you've seen the Conservatory of Flowers. It's hard to miss, being made out of wood and glass, and it's entirely white. The building is 140 years old this year, and it's one of the most elaborate structures in the park. Every day, people drive, walk, and bike past this historic landmark. But do you know what exactly goes on inside? KLW's True Gwynn brings us the story from our archives.
Golden Gate Park's Conservatory of Flowers is San Francisco's very own Victorian greenhouse. Lo Hodges, Director of Operations and Exhibitions, says it's more than a building. She thinks of it like a person who's lived a long life.
She's a one of a kind because, well, the rest have basically fallen down. You know, there's a reason they don't make greenhouses out of wood anymore. But it's totally worth it.
Hodges loves her work.
No, I have the absolute best job in the world. Half of my job is getting to work with the coolest group of horticulturalists on the planet to come up with fun, whimsical, wacky ways, basically to teach little kids and big kids about plants.
As the director, Hodges oversees exhibits ranging from recreated Jurassic landscapes to historical moments in San Francisco. Hodges says this type of prefabricated greenhouse is rare. The structure is like Victorian IKEA.
Somebody back in the day picked her out of a catalog, and she was sent to them in crates, and you sort of had it set up.
In this case, that somebody was James Lick.
And I know for like California listeners out there, for sure, they can probably think of at least one thing named after him, Lick Observatory, there's a school, there's freeways. And he was just wealthy as all get out.
But Lick passed away before he could get the greenhouse built, and a group of other rich San Franciscans, Leland Stanford and Charles Crocker included, bought the kit. It was then donated to the city and opened to the public in 1879. It's delighted San Franciscans ever since.
Right now we're in the Highland Tropics, so this is the cool room.
Nursery specialist Mario Vega has cared for the conservatory's plants for over 8 years. The Highland Tropics Gallery is meant to mimic the climate of cloud forests you'd find in the mountains of South America, somewhere like Machu Picchu in Peru.
Well, one of the unique things about this room is the collection of cool-growing orchids. For instance, the Draculas, which are right here in front of us.
Vega says the name has nothing to do with blood-sucking monsters. It's about dragons.
If you look into the flower, you can kind of see a face, and it was thought to resemble a dragon. And it also has the hinged lip that moves about in the wind, and that attracts pollinators.
That gets a particular fly incredibly excited, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A
mm-hmm.
flower is really just a fancy way of attracting a mate to get laid.
After ogling Dracula orchids, Vega and Hodges continue into the aquatics gallery.
We are now going from, somewhere above 3,000 feet in altitude to sea level.
A huge concrete pond takes up most of the space. The air in here is more humid. It's warm and sticky. Carnivorous pitcher plants hang like vines while they lure bugs for lunch. Some of the larger pitcher plants, though, can catch bigger meals.
And these are even bigger.
Yeah, they're purported to catch small rodents.
Despite the flesh-eating plants, this room is calming. You can get a sense of what it might be like to sit next to a trickling creek in the rainforest. While Vega and his team work to maintain the gallery's tropical climates, forests outside the conservatory are on their own. Rainforests once covered 14% of the earth, but that number is down to 6%. This living museum is meant to bring people and plants together. Lo Hodges says if she can get city kids to have one connection to plants, she's done her job.
So great ones are looking at the cacao tree or the chocolate. I mean, again, most little kids, you think of chocolate, you unwrap it, it comes in a bar, right? It's a sugary thing that you think of and you get at the 7-Eleven, whatnot. But showing kids the plant it comes from, and I say kids, big kids, little kids, but hopefully visitors, you know, they go home and the next time they're eating chocolate, it clicks.
It clicks for Hodges and Vega too, even though they worked here for years. They still take in the delights just like kids. Hodges reaches out and rips a piece of bark off a tree.
Smell that cinnamon.
Oh, it smells really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me about it?
Yeah, it makes me want to make cookies.
This work, Vega says, is his dream job.
Well, I remember coming here as a young kid and then through my teens and always thinking, you know, that this was the gold standard for tropical horticulture.
Vega and his colleagues are working to maintain that gold standard, so the next generation of the coolest group of horticulturalists on the planet has a place to belong. At the Conservatory of Flowers, I'm Truk Nguyen for Cross Currents.
Have you got a signature sound of the Bay Area you'd like to hear a story about? Connect with us at news@kalw.org. We'd love to check it out and maybe share it with the rest of the Bay Area.
The colors are bright, bright as ever, red.
Now, it's time to hear from a local band with an upcoming gig you can go check out. This is Jay Somm, originally from Walnut Creek. She's performing at the Fillmore in San Francisco this Saturday night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Julia Linus Goodman, Kristen McCandless, Marissa Ortega Welch, Michael Locke Swingen, and Alice Wolfley. Our engineers are James Rollins and Tarek Foda. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.